Hey everyone, welcome to Guards of Eden. Today's guest is Karina White. I was introduced to Karina from afar, of course, when she was working in a sports management company that was an all-female office. It was an insight that I found really interesting, but of course what I did learn sooner rather than later was that this was just a small part of what made Karina as fantastic as she is as a person. I got to listen to her story in this episode, and I think the general tone of everything is probably quite symbolic of not only what makes Karina special, but it actually ends up representing who she is, which is, it was such a fun conversation. I was laughing throughout. I was laughing when I was listening to it back, but it also just had pearls of wisdom throughout and pearls of insight that made me really think and feel all these different things on all these different topics. We get to discuss not only Karina's journey as a mum, but also as a podcaster, where she's one quarter of a fantastic team with the podcast Black Mums Up Front, which I can't recommend enough. It's absolutely fantastic what they're building there. But also her as a businesswoman working in the sports management industry. This idea of not only just being a woman in a sports industry, but also being a black woman in a sports industry. And we cover the intersectionality of what that presented through her time and currently still presents itself. So I can't speak highly enough of just the woman that Karina is and the human being that she is. It's an episode I just loved. I really, really loved it. And I'll be honest, I don't want to take too much time away from you listening to this. But whilst you're here, please check out the show notes and go and support what Karina's got going on. I believe that if you add Karina into your life, it will be enriched. But also, if you're listening to this on Apple, please leave a rating and a review. And please subscribe if you do enjoy this episode. But without further ado, a great episode is on the way. So 3, 2, 1, let's go. Hey Karina, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm really excited to be here, actually.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really excited too.
Yeah, honestly, yeah. I love the whole concept of the podcast and stuff. So yeah, and I know we've been trying to make this happen for so long. So it's nice to finally get around to being a guest. So thank you for having me.
That's no problem. I'm really excited. And as a fantastic podcaster yourself, as we'll talk about, kind of hearing you say that and how you like the podcast, it just makes my heart very warm. So thank you very much. So question number one, I ask every guest this question. I have a Spotify playlist, which is the Guards of Eden soundtrack. It is so that every guest gives me a contribution of a song that makes them either feel happy or reminds them of a really positive memory. So Karina, can you give me a song that either makes you feel really happy or you have a positive memory attached to it?
Does it have to be one?
Unfortunately, so. And I'm.
Oh, it's a tough one. There's two. Can I be really cheeky and give two?
Of course, of course.
Just because I'm a rebel. So yes. I really hate following the rules. So, so the first one would be Berris Hammond.
Oh.
I Feel Good.
Okay.
Which is a reggae song. It's like, I feel good when I'm wrapped up in your arms, dancing to a reggae song. That, like, it's just because I'm Jamaican, I'm so proud of my heritage. Like, that song, it's just, yeah, I absolutely love it. And then the other one would be, it's quite a new song by Fat Joe called Sunshine.
Yep, yeah.
And absolutely love it. And I cannot wait for the sun to be out in this summer, hopefully. And I'm just going to like turn it up in the car, and that's going to be like my anthem for the summer. So those are the two songs at the moment. Well, Berris Hammond is like a timeless one. It always makes me feel good. But Fat Joe, Sunshine, yeah, it's a new song. But ever since I first heard it, like, that is my song. That is my song.
I love it. I love both of them. So they are going to live both as a pair. You're going to be the first one,
yay,
to have a dual song, and I love it.
Everyone knows I'm a rebel, so it's not surprising.
Well, they're going to live on the Guards of Eden soundtrack, and that currently lives in the show notes if you are listening to this on Spotify. So Karina, How do you remember your childhood growing up in South London? And what was a young Karina like growing up?
A young Karina was a mouthy little git. I was the middle child, so I always had something to say, always. I remember once my aunt was over from Jamaica and she tried to tell me off about something. I was probably being rude, to be honest. Not rude, actually. I wasn't rude. I just had a lot to say. Like, I always had an answer for everything. And I think she tried to tell me off. And I said to her, "You can't tell me off. You're not my mum." And I remember my mum came in from work and my aunt told her. And my aunt was like, my mum was like, "I never know why you never give her two licks. She's too rude. She always have something to say." And like, it's never changed really as I've got older. The same thing. She's always got something to say. That's what, you know, it's my school reports in uni. My friends will say, like, even now, they always say she's always got something to say. But yeah, childhood was, I had very, very, very happy childhood memories. If it wasn't, you know, spending summers in Jamaica, it was, you know, spending time with my family. And yeah, I grew up in a very, very happy home in a very traditional Jamaican household, you know, food wise, music wise, culture wise. My mum got ill when I was probably about 11. So, you know, for some people's normality in their teenage years would be, you know, going to school and arguing with your parents and, you know, that's their normal. Mine and my siblings' normals were, you know, spending evenings after school in the hospital whilst my mum was having chemo if she was in hospital overnight. Like, that was my normal. But I can't ever remember a time where I felt sad in doing that, you know, because that was just normal for us, sitting on my mum's hospital bed doing our homework and, you know, laughing with my sister, my brother. Like, it was our normal, but we were still happy. So yeah, I had a very, very happy childhood. And I don't know if, you know, my family would say that it was happy for them, because I definitely always had something to say. But I mean, I had a happy childhood. So yeah.
Yeah, you were the one saying things. So you had a great time, right?
Yeah. Honestly, I always had to have the last say in everything. So, yeah.
I love that so much. And one thing you've mentioned, even with your song, is that you're a proud Jamaican woman. So I was wondering if you can speak to kind of what Jamaican pride looked like for you growing up and why it is so important for you to celebrate that part of who you are.
Yeah, I think Jamaican pride for me growing up was... My parents were the epitome of kind of Jamaica. They represented that. Both of them came here when they were quite young from Jamaica and worked their butts off to, you know, provide for me and my siblings, to provide for each other and to kind of make a name for themselves, essentially, in, you know, just working hard. And I think when I go to Jamaica and I look at kind of work ethic, it's second to none. You know, I've been in Jamaica seeing people that are, you know, 70, 75 years old building patios or building verandas. And I'm just like, do you know how hot it is? Like, and you're out here, like, I can just about do 20 minutes in the gym, like in London, let alone be like building stuff in like the blazing hot heat at 70. Like, it's crazy. But yeah, I think for me it was like, I'm extremely proud of my heritage, and I think that's because of the way that I was raised. The kind of the Jamaican culture really fed into that in terms of, you know, morals, values, work ethic, food, alcohol, you know, all of that makes me who I am today. But definitely my parents, and I think as a Black woman as well, it's really, really important to know your heritage and to know where you come from and, you know, what made you who you are. So yeah, incredibly proud of my heritage. And I think also I'm incredibly privileged to know my heritage as well. You know, my parents were both born there, so I'm first generation British, but I don't know whether I would call myself exclusively British, just because Jamaican culture has had such an influence in my upbringing and who I am as a person. But at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, first and second generation British people who have never been back home or never been, you know, back to the Caribbean. And so there sometimes is that disconnect. Whereas for me, you know, my daughter and I, we go back every year. So she is very clued up on Jamaica, Jamaican culture, food, values, morals. And I think it's really important for her to know that and to know her heritage as well.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. I got to go to Jamaica maybe when I was about 6 with my mum. So my godmother at the time was dating a Jamaican man, and we went and saw their family who lived there. And yeah, I just remember it as paradise. I can't remember it as anything otherwise. It was
it just was.
The people were amazing. The food was fantastic. The sunsets were like stuff that you like dream about when you see them here. You see people say, oh, the sunset's really nice. And I do, like, it's so vivid in my mind, even like 20 plus years later, this idea of like just how beautiful, like, all the scenery and everything was. So yeah, I don't blame
it's
you.
It's crazy. Yeah, no, it's crazy. You know, there are some parts that aren't necessarily, you know, you have, like any country, you have, you know, the towns and places where, you know, it's not as scenic, but I wouldn't change it for the world. You know, being when I go and visit like cousins and aunts and, you know, my friends and stuff in downtown Kingston, it reminds me just that actually Jamaica is just like any other country, in that, you know, you have your you have the places that are rich in culture, or, you know, rich in money, and then you have others that aren't so much, but they're still such beautiful places to visit in Jamaica. And it's probably the one place in the world that if I'm feeling super stressed or just super like I need a break, I can go to Jamaica and sit on my uncle's veranda and I feel at peace, like instantly, straight away. It doesn't matter. And I think for a country or a place to have that effect on someone, it's got to be a special place.
Yeah. And it's, once again, I think maybe that idea of knowing your heritage, and it, they're an element of like, it feels like home. It gives you that peace of, this feels like there's just something like spiritual and generational that's maybe gives you that peace and like serenity with the area. I don't blame you. I'm not from there, but I remember just, nothing but positive memories from my time there, even at such a young age. I've been fortunate enough to go to a few different countries, and it is one place that it stuck with me all those years, even at that age. So you said that you talk a lot, and this is something I wanted to talk to you about, the idea of wanting to be a presenter growing up. And I guess it's a twofold question. So firstly, I guess mainly, what drew you to wanting to become a presenter? And then how amazing was it to see your sister Charlene have such an amazing presenting career that's obviously still going, but your sister being the first black woman to present news at 10 on BBC, and to have this fantastic career alongside the career that you've built, being able to share that with your sister, with understanding the passion you have for that.
So I actually always wanted to be a doctor. Like I wanted to be a presenter, but that came after my dreams of being a doctor were just squashed. Wow. Like I always wanted to be a doctor from when I was about, I think, so my aunt in Miami, she's a doctor. Okay. And we spent Christmas there, and I went to her doctor's practice. She owns her own doctor surgery. And I think I spent a couple of days there. And then I always was like, oh my God, I want to be a doctor, just like Auntie Arlene. I want to be a doctor. I want to be a doctor. So that was my thing. I wanted to be a doctor. I'm not squeamish at all. So, you know, like in biology lessons and stuff where you have to like dissect frogs and stuff, like that was like the best biology lesson like you could ever have me in. Like I was like the first one there, apron on, everything. Right, girls, scalpel. Yep, I'm good to go. Let's start dissecting this frog. And also always wanted to be a doctor. And then it got to my A-levels, and I had a biology teacher that absolutely hated me. And so I had two biology teachers. One absolutely hated me. The other one absolutely loved me. Two assignments, two pieces of coursework for the same subject, two different teachers. I got a D in the one with the teacher hates me. And to this day, I even remember what the assignment was. It was like, the assignment was explain how water is essential to life. And I wrote this whole essay around like why we can't live without water and why it's essential to the human body and just life in general, and stuff like that. Then I wrote one, essay for the other biology teacher, and I got an A. And I was like, this is how it's going to be, isn't it? For the whole of my 2 years doing my A-levels, am I even going to get the qualifications that I need to go to university to study medicine when this one teacher does not like me? She's just making my whole experience of doing biology at A-levels awful. And I just thought, you know what? I'm not doing this with you. So I dropped biology, and she squashed my dreams of being a doctor. And then I thought, well, what else am I good at? So I'm not squeamish, which is why I wanted to be a doctor. So I'm not going to do that anymore. So what else can I do? So I said, oh, you know what? I can talk. Why don't I be a presenter? So again, always wanted to be a presenter or to do acting, actually. I dabbled in acting as well. And it didn't really turn out that way that I'd become a presenter, but I've kind of gone full circle in that, you know, I do presenting, I guess, as a podcaster. But incredibly proud of my sister. And, you know, some would say, Luca, that I taught her everything that she knows.
Well, like, you've said it, and I agree, you know. Yeah, I just taught her
everything she knows. So, I mean, I'm incredibly proud of my muse, Charlene. Yeah. But no, no, seriously, I'm incredibly proud of my sister. She is literally my best friend, and I couldn't be more proud of everything that she's achieved, everything she stands for, and just the support that she has given me over the years, really. But yeah, she's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and look, the podcasting world and the sports management world needed you, so, you know, there's only one Karina White, so, you know...
Yeah, I definitely try and make a mark wherever I go, so, yeah.
I love it. Something that you've mentioned about your mum, and you've spoken about it before in terms of she eventually passed away, rest in peace, to when you were 17 years old of bowel cancer. But I wanted you to, as much as you wish to be comfortable speaking about it, what type of mum your mum was, and do you think it impacted... And in what way do you think it impacted you and what you would become as a mum with Soraya?
My mum was probably one of the kindest women I've ever known, but still very, she wasn't strict, but she was still very firm. And if anyone listening knows kind of like what a Jamaican woman is like, she's, you know, very, very, very loving, but still very firm. I remember one of my friends in school, Vicky, in secondary school, she got kicked out of her house. And I was like, Mum, can Vicky come and stay? She's been kicked out of her house, blah, blah, blah. Mum was like, yeah, fine, not a problem. So Vicky comes over, and bless her, white girl from a very, very middle-class background, like used to being, like, and she was an only child as well. So very, very spoiled. And essentially she got kicked out. She was just trying to rebel. And her parents was like, no, Vicky, we're not doing this. Go, don't want you in the house. My mum was like, yeah, Vicky can come. And bless her, I don't really think she knew what she'd let herself in for, because she got to my house, put her stuff down, and I went downstairs, and she went to lie down on the sofa. And my mum was like, Vicky, what are you doing? Get up, please, and come and help cook dinner. My mum was like, I don't care whether you're here as a guest, like, you're going to help out. And so Vicky was kind of like, what? And my mum was like, you heard me, come on. Come and make the salad. And, you know, that was very much my mum. Like, she had such a kind heart, but at the same time, she wasn't gonna let you get away with anything. Like, you had to, you know, get your shit together. And yeah, so Vicky had to do chores exactly the same way that we did. But, you know, yeah, my mum was incredibly kind-hearted. She wasn't easy on us, definitely firm, but still loving. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that, you know, she had been diagnosed with cancer. And I think to a certain degree, she was trying to prepare us
for potentially a life without her being around. And that's essentially what ended up happening. And I think the way that my mum grew us all, like my siblings, and also the relationship that she had with our wider family, like my cousins, my aunts, my uncles, also set us up in good stead to have an amazing support system around us when she did pass away. And I think for me as a mum, when I had Soraya, I was kind of like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm 25. I don't know how to be a mum. Like, what do I do? Yeah. And actually, a lot of the ways that my mum brought us up, which was just, you just get on with it. So I feel like I've been winging parenthood for the last 11 years, but it's worked. I haven't killed my daughter. She's still alive. She still gets fed every day. We still have a roof over our head. So I haven't done too badly, although I've been winging it. I haven't done too badly. But yeah, I definitely think the way that we were raised definitely had an effect on how I was able to manage without my mum being around, and essentially how I then went on to be able to become a parent. And not even just, I can't give credit to, you know, myself solely, but also just because of the extended family and our family relationships that my mum had built and ensured, you know, would still stand firm and stand strong even in her absence.
Yeah. By the way, that's incredibly powerful. Like, I think the idea of being able to just say, yeah, I was winging it, but we're like all good. And I think, because I think maybe the expectation is, if you're a parent, that everyone's figured it out or everyone has everything 100% worked out. And I think, I mean, I'm wild assumption here of my own mum and dad, but like, my mum and dad were young when they had me. So my dad was 20 and my mum was 24. And I think there's probably like an element that they were winging it too. Like, if I'm speaking for them, and it's, yeah, you kept me alive and I'm in an all right place now. So
yeah, exactly. And I think I really do, like, if any parents are listening, please, you don't have to have it together. If you do have it together, brilliant, great. Please tell us your secret. I don't have it together at all. I know many of my friends don't have it together either. And that's okay. As long as your kids are happy and you are happy and, you know, they're getting to school, you know, that's all that matters. You know, we don't have, you know, a Bible of how to be a parent. There's no right or wrong way in how to parent. It's what works for you and your family. And like I said, as long as you're happy, then that's the main thing. You know, for the last year, a lot of us have been having to homeschool our kids and spending more time with our kids. And I'd say it very openly and honestly, I didn't sign up to be around my daughter 24 hours a day. I didn't. When I became a mum, I thought, okay, cool. You're around them 24/7 until they go to nursery. No one is designed to be around any other individual 24/7 for long periods of time, not even your husband, your wife, or whatever. It's not normal. You need your own space. So I'll be the first one to hold my hands up and say, my daughter got on my nerves at times over lockdown. And I'm sure she would probably say the same thing, that I got on her nerves. And there were days when I was like, I'm not going to stress myself out homeschooling her or getting her onto homeschool, because this isn't a normal situation that we're in. I'm not a teacher. I'm a mum. And yes, teaching is an element of that, but I'm not a teacher and I don't have the patience to be a teacher. And also half of the stuff, I don't remember learning some of the stuff that they learn now in school when I was their age, like, honestly. And maybe I was talking too much and don't remember. I don't know. But and so I just think that with, like, there's so much pressure put on us as parents to, you know, have it together, be perfect, and to do everything that society tells you should be doing. And actually, we don't get it right sometimes. And yeah, I'm winging it, and that's okay.
Yeah, 100%. Just couldn't agree more. I just think there's just so much power in it. I think you being able to just be honest, and yeah, I couldn't agree more with the fact that that's probably the vast majority of parents, but also just how much value that it just says everything about you. I think this idea of, you know, it comes from a good place, and it's, you know, it's an acceptance of what you're learning along the way. So yeah, I love it. And it's something that it leads to something that, firstly, it's you saying it, it's like you said it somewhere, I believe it was a podcast episode or an interview, but something I'm always curious of with parents is this idea of your entire identity being wrapped up in being a parent, and sometimes potentially losing the human being. So, and something you mentioned, you spoke about it and you put it in a really beautiful way, but I was wondering if you can speak to the idea of prioritizing Karina, the woman, the human being, knowing that you've got to take care of you before you can have the capacity and capability to take care of anybody else, whether that's Karina, the career woman, or the entrepreneur, or the podcaster, or Karina, Soraya's mum. So I was wondering if you could just share, you put it in a way that was very, it resonated with me at the time, the idea of I've got to prioritize taking care of Karina, the woman and human being, and then understanding that that has a trickle down effect on everybody that engages with me.
Yeah. So I hear it a lot that people say, you know, you've got to put your child first. You've got to put your child first. You've got to put your child first. And don't get me wrong, sometimes you do have to put your child first, but you also have to put yourself first. Because if I'm not happy, I can't be a mum. I can't get up and go to work. I can't be, you know, the greatest friend to my friends or to my family or whatever if I'm not happy. So there's so many times that I have to put myself first, because I want to be the best version of myself to exist in this world, and also to have positive and strong relationships with those around me. You can't do that if you're not happy within yourself. And I think there's definitely times where I put myself first and I'm like, do you know what? I need to practice self-care and put myself before my daughter. So sometimes it might be if I'm having a really stressful day, or I know I'm in a really bad mood or whatever, I've put her to bed and she might have had, you know, chips or something because I've just been so busy and I haven't been able to cook. But it might be that afterwards I'm like, actually, you know what, I want to cheer myself up, so I'm going to order waffles and ice cream. I'm going to put myself first to have a little bit of something nice for myself, you know. Or it might be that actually I want to, I don't know, buy myself something nice, but there's only enough money to buy myself something and not my daughter something, you know. And I think if I was to ask my daughter, is she really happy, she tells me all the time, like, mum, I love you, mum, you're the best. And I think for her, she knows I go above and beyond to do things for her, but I can't sacrifice my mental health in doing things. But it doesn't mean that things don't get done for her. It just sometimes means that I'm limited in the things that I can do, or I pull back on certain things just so I can put myself first. I used to hear a lot where people would say, if someone was out and about, like raving or partying or whatever, and they're like, where's her child? Shouldn't they be at home with their kids? Or, I'm sorry, I didn't know at 11 o'clock at night my child would be awake. Like, she's sleeping. So I'm going out and I'm putting myself first because I need a night out. I'm going out. And if I choose to go out every weekend, I'm going to go out every weekend, because by the time she's awake in the morning, I'm back home. So she's actually none the wiser as to whether I went out or not, because by the time she's gone to sleep, that's when I go out. She wakes up in the morning, I'm up, and, you know, I do what I've got to do as a mother. But I do think that people need to be the best version of themselves to be able to parent, to be able to be a wife, a mother, a friend, a sister. And they can't do that if they're constantly putting everybody else before themselves, including their kids.
Yeah.
You know, I think you've got to prioritize yourself and be the best version of you before you can try and be the best mum or friend or brother or whatever it might be.
Yeah. I just couldn't agree more. And it's just something I'm always very curious of with parents, the idea of keeping yourself, the human being, as like an integral part of who you are amongst being a parent or a boss or all these different kind of hats we wear in life, but being understanding and being very in tune with the self and understanding that that's kind of the center of the universe of everything kind of going around it. But I'm really happy you spoke about that.
Thank you. I want
to get into your career, because I guess I know a very limited amount, but I'm really excited to hear you talk about it. But the idea of getting into sports management, it was you'd worked, I'm assuming, in music previously, and then one New Year's Eve you had a chance meeting that led to kind of a redirection of your career. So can you speak to that New Year's Eve and how your early days were in the sports management industry?
Yeah, so literally it was New Year's Eve. It was the same New Year's Eve, actually, that I think my dad got engaged to my stepmom. I'm sure it was. And I wasn't doing anything. And my friend had rang me the night before. And she said, oh, what are you doing New Year's? And I said, oh, I'm not doing anything. And she went, right. There's a club that I'm working at and they need somebody to do the door, take payments and all that stuff. Do you want to work? And, you know, you get good money because it's New Year's Eve. So I was like, sure, I'm not doing anything. So made my way up to central London and was on the door. And I think it must have been like £40 or £30 or something to get into the club. I can't remember, but, you know, it's always like double on New Year's. Yeah. And so there was this massive queue. And I was taking money, letting people in, stamping them. And then this guy came and he was like, oh, how much is it? So I said, oh, it's £30 or £40, however much it was. And I think it was 40. And he said, oh, I don't have £40. So I was like, well, you can't come in. And he went, oh, go on. Just do me a favor. And I was like, no, it's £40. Either you pay the £40 or you move out of the way, like, because you're holding up the queue. And he was like, oh, go on. All right, I tell you what, how about if I give you £20 and you take £10 for yourself and you just put the other £10 in the till? That way it's a win-win situation. So I was like, how about no, no, either you pay the £40 or, like I said, get out the queue. Cut a long story short, it was his club night. So he was kind of testing me to see, like, if I was there, like, stealing money or whatever. And he basically, like, he said to me, oh, I'm winding you up, it's my club night, whatever. So I was like, so do you have the £40? So we got chatting anyway, and he basically was saying that he was looking for he'd just qualified as a football agent and he was going to be starting his own business soon. So he wanted somebody who he trusted to come and work for him. So I was like, okay. So he was like, I'm going to keep in touch and I'm going to shout you when I'm ready to open the office. So I said, okay, cool. And he did. He kept in touch and we became really good friends. And yeah, he kept true to his word. He gave me a job. And that's essentially how I got my first start working in sports management. And I honestly have to say, if it wasn't for Leon, Euban and Dan, and they were my first three bosses in football, I probably wouldn't be the person that I am today. Wow. Because, you know, working, being a female, working sports, this is going back, you know, 11, 12, 13 years ago, when it wasn't really, you didn't really have many women that worked on the business side of sports at all. Like, I was an anomaly, even more so because I'm Black. So it was like, you know, I would go to, I would hear comments like, oh, you know, you just want to be a wag. That's why you're working in football. And, you know, all of these kind of microaggression statements, and you kind of have to just ignore them and let them go over your head. And I remember there was a time when, you know, I think entering into that industry, I was very naive because I kind of thought, oh, you know, no one's going to, I didn't even think it. It didn't come into my thought process that being a woman would be an issue working in that industry at all. Like, and because of the way the boys were with me as well in the office, like, they just treated me like one of the lads. So there was never any kind of distinguished line that I was female and they were male. Like, they were always so supportive of me. I remember there was a time that I went to, it was a transfer window deadline, and Leon had a meeting with the chairman of a football club, and he couldn't make it because he had to go and do a deal for another player. And he was like, Karina, can you go and, like, meet this chairman, blah, 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 because our player, our client wanted to leave the club. The club wanted him to stay. So Leon was like, you know, can you go and have a chat, find out what's going on, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, all right, cool. So I've gone to this club. I've turned up for the appointment. The club secretary has shown me into the boardroom. I've sat down. The chairman's come in and he's looked me up and down. He's like, where's Leon? So I said, oh, Leon isn't able to make it. I thought he had called to let you know, but I'm here. He had like a clash, so I'm here. And the guy said, well, I'm not going to talk grown man business with a woman. And I was so taken back that I kind of paused and literally, you know, when in like the movies, when you see someone pause and you're trying to, they're trying to figure out, they're like playing in their head the scenario of if they say one thing or if they say another thing. And I was like, all right, cool. So do I get South London on you or do I keep it professional? So I thought, okay, cool. So I just said to him, you don't have to talk grown man business with me, but our player wants to leave, so I can leave now and he will leave with me. It's entirely up to you. So he kind of was like, well, I guess I've got a couple of minutes to sit and talk to you. And yeah, that's essentially how I kind of started building my resilience working in football. But one thing I would say is the boys I worked with, they were brilliant. They would have no one talk any slack about me at all. Like, they always had my back, always. And I think having that support, having those allies that you actually work with and that support you, was absolutely brilliant. You know, when I left there and I went to work for a club, I remember being asked by my boss at the time, like, it was winter, so I had on like over the knee boots. And he asked me if they were my come fuck me boots, if I wore them for my man at night. And I was like, you're disgusting.
Yeah.
Like, actually a dick. But it was weird because I was the only black girl in the whole of that kind of department. And I didn't feel empowered to say anything because coming from a place where I'm surrounded by men, but men who have my back, they would never dream of saying something like that to me, like, ever. So then going into there, that was a little bit of a shock. And to this day, I'm really pissed off with myself because I'm like, I should have said something. But everything happens for a reason, because now you couldn't say that to me. You couldn't run those jokes with me at all, like at all. So I think if I didn't have those experiences, I definitely wouldn't be the person that I am today and feel empowered to be able to stick up for myself or to stick up for others or to call people out.
Yeah. I mean, firstly, like, yeah, that's it's disgusting, I think. But to give you a bit of credit, this idea of, I completely understand, like, Karina now would probably, yeah, those jokes just wouldn't run anyway societally. But I think we often don't realize, like, just how different culture must have been when you were in that industry then, and how transformational some of the conversation around gender, around race, all these different things, where there's maybe a heightened sensitivity to the idea of just having a bit more self-discipline, like something crossing your mind, even if you are someone that would make that kind of joke. This idea of like, oh no, in today's culture, you can get in loads of trouble for that. So I think, yeah, maybe because it wasn't something that we maybe celebrated in women and in black women in particular, this idea of being vocal, being empowered, being able to say, no, don't say that, that's fucking disgusting, like, you shouldn't be like talking to people that you work with that way. I think it's just this idea of now, thankfully, it's one of the blessings of kind of these transcendent like movements that have been happening in the past, I'd say in the past like 7 to, you know, 8 years in particular. Yeah. But yeah, I don't blame you for not saying something back then. And I also completely, I can imagine the internal battle of being like, I wish I just told him to shut his fucking mouth.
Yeah.
And like, you know, yeah, because we would empower you, like, you know, even as me as a white man, I have to think of it through my lens. I would definitely empower someone now if I heard that joke, to empower a woman, especially a woman of color, to be like, that's some wrong shit. And you can't just go around talking to people like that anyway. I think that, yeah, that it's more celebrated now being able to stand up for someone that may be underrepresented, which is still an issue massively, as you know, being someone that is still in connection with the sports industry, especially in the past year, there's just been a massive spotlight on just how prevalent racism and sexism is in the football world, especially. So yeah, I don't blame you for feeling that way. And yeah, I would celebrate South London Karina, letting a few people know.
No, honestly, South London Karina comes out quite a bit, but yeah, maybe in more of a professional sense these days.
I'd be thoroughly enjoying someone getting their talking to in that respect.
Honestly, I keep telling people, don't let my social media personality fool you. I feel like sometimes people, like, I personally think I am a lovely person, but don't get on the wrong side of me, because you won't like it. I'm from South London and I'm Jamaican, and also I just don't care.
Yeah, exactly. Don't play.
Yeah, like, don't play yourself, Baz.
Something in the sport industry that this actually, I think, was my introduction to you in a strange way, was that you were working for an all-female office at one point in the sports management industry.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could speak to maybe the environment. It doesn't even necessarily have to be purely positive, but maybe I'm assuming that there were some benefits of being in a female office and being understood of the underrepresentation, these snidey comments, all these different kind of mistreatments that come with being a woman in the sports industry and in the football industry in particular. So,
I guess I think working in an all-female office, you know, women tend to just get stuff done. So, you know, we get stuff done. So that was definitely a positive in that, you know, regardless, doesn't matter, trials, tribulations, we find a way to get it done and to have a positive outcome. So that was always going to be, you know, positive. And the experience definitely was a really positive one. One thing I would say is, you know, people always say it must be so easy for you working in, you know, all female office. And yes, it was brilliant. But also as well, there's that question around intersectionality, because I was still the only black woman working there. So although, yes, we are all female, you know, we all still come from very different cultures, and still sometimes it can be very lonely when you are the only black person in the room or the only black woman in the room. And it just gets tiresome sometimes when you're having to be that voice, or, you know, when you're in meetings or you're going to see you know, businesses or meet broadcasters and stuff. Like, I don't always want to have to be the one that brings up issues around race, or, you know, having people think about these things that negatively affect or have a disadvantage to people of color. Like, I don't always want to be the person that raises that. Like, sometimes we need allies to take that on board as well, and to be aware of those things. So, and I'm not saying that was within the organization that I worked in, but just in terms of, you know, it was absolutely amazing working in an all-female office. But at the same time, just because we're female, we're not all the same, and we still have different kind of struggles and things that we have to battle with, and that we still are at a disadvantage of.
Yeah. And I listened to an interview you did. I believe it was a radio interview, and I think, I don't know how it was posed, but it was this idea of, they kind of framed the question of, like, racism versus sexism, which would be the one you wanted to address first, and you put it very simply. It was very powerful, because of, you did it so succinctly. You said, firstly, I'm black, then I'm a woman. And it was just, in that moment, you put it so simply and in such a, you know, a poetic way in that sense. It's that idea of, unfortunately, it is still, like, the thing that it sticks out first, right? It's the thing that it is, for me anyway, it's the more, I'm not even going to say more, that's definitely wrong, but the idea of, it's still such a prevalent issue, it's still such a, it's going to take so much effort from a wide variety of people. Like you said, it can't just be you bringing the topic of race into everything, because it's, you know, on us, on white people, we have to do our part. We have to earn our hard yards of being like, it shouldn't have to be the responsibility of a black person to constantly have to bring that conversation to the table. So yeah, I remember listening and just being, yeah, wowed, I guess, I think, because you put it in such a like short way, but in such a powerful way. It was so direct. And and it actually,
I was just gonna say, yeah, I think that it's you know, when you see someone, the first thing you see, or when you see a black person, I don't think you see a black person, you say, oh, they're a woman, oh, and they're black. Yeah. It's they're a black woman. Yeah. You know, and I can't take that away, and I don't want that to be taken away from me either. Like, I'm incredibly proud of who I am, and I don't want my ethnicity to have to define how people treat me. Mm. Same way I don't want my gender to have to define how people treat me. But unfortunately, it is going to be that way. And until it isn't, definitely ethnicity and race is probably one of the things that we have to, or I feel that I have to fight for, alongside sexism and, you know, equality for women. But I think the fight around kind of racism doesn't just affect women, it affects children, it affects men. It's so kind of just there subtly and overtly that I can't be a woman first. I'm black first, and then I'm a woman.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, I'm really happy that you said this. Like, it shouldn't, not only should it not define you, but it also shouldn't be something that you shouldn't be proud of. Like, it's, you know, it's celebrating the person that you are, and that idea is, yeah, I'm happy that you said that, because I completely agree. There shouldn't be something that, yeah. I just agree. I'm just in wholehearted agreement. But
thank you.
One thing that I've really respected and loved about you, and you don't know this because it's just me as a fan from afar, but I think that one thing that you've done is this idea, and people are probably hearing this from the conversation, but it's this idea that you've blended being really fun, really personable, really authentically like you as Karina, but also someone that's been very professional and worked in, like you said, being in boardrooms with chairmen of clubs. And so you've managed to like blend this like mix of very much who you are, which is from me, from what I see, is fun, loving, caring, all these different like beautiful traits that maybe you don't associate straight away with professionalism, but you've managed to blend them both. And I was wondering, is it something that's evolved over time, like getting comfortable with who you are and also your career? Or is it something that you were just like, this is me, and there's an element of you figure it out around me just being who I am?
I definitely think it's evolved. And as I've got a little bit more senior in my career, I just don't care. Like, whatever. Like, if I have fucking green hair, it doesn't mean that I can't do my job. Like, whatever. Like, if I, you know, I'm out screaming, hey, in a club on a weekend, or, you know, at a brunch or whatever, it doesn't mean that I'm not going to fucking get contracts signed during the week. Like, it doesn't, what I do outside of work or who I am doesn't mean that I can't do my job in a professional sense. And I think for me, it's really important, especially as a mother, for me to show to my daughter, to the next generation coming up, and even just my generation who may not be quite there yet in their career, or who are battling with that same kind of, I'm not really myself in a professional setting because I'm not able to be. And I know not every industry is like that, but I can still be me and I can still do my job. So if people don't like it, that's not my problem. That's their problem to deal with. Like, I still get my job done. I still am happy. I'm still smiling. I still get stuff done. And for me, that is the main thing. I want people to know that you can show up at work, and you should be able to show up at work and be your authentic self and still be seen as professional. Just because your idea of professional doesn't fit somebody else's idea of what professionalism is, so what? As long as you're getting the job done and you are being professional when need be, then why not be your authentic self? And I think, you know, I battled a lot with, you know, having to speak a certain way, or, you know, not speaking about my ethnicity or my culture, or, you know, being from South London, and like, whatever, take that as you want, because it's not going to change who I am. That's who I am. And I'm incredibly proud of my story, me, my family, my background, where I grew up, my friends. And yeah, it's just, it definitely wasn't always like that. But it's got to the point now where, like, even when I'm on Twitter and I'm tweeting about certain stuff, I think, I wonder if, like, my boss or people from work can see this. And I'm like, do you know what? I don't care. They've probably learned something new about me that they might not have known before. So, you know, and I'm always dragging someone on Twitter. So.
No, it's firstly, that was really profound. I loved that. And yeah, it was just something that really struck me because you've spoken about it already, like the idea of like my brand on social media. And I think the sporting industry, whether it's the players themselves, whether it's their representatives, I feel like the narrative is that you have to paint a picture and you have to be very much in control of the narrative, and whether that's the hyper-professional person or God, like the footballer doesn't want to say anything wrong or all these different things. I just think it's incredibly refreshing to see you be you and just be like, you know, this is me, and yeah, I can go have fun with my friends on the weekend and then go crush my job during the week. Yeah. So yeah, I loved it. And
also I just think when you're not yourself, especially on social media, that's when you fall into the pit of potentially saying something or doing something that doesn't fall in line with your brand and then being called out for it or people wanting to cancel you or whatever. I don't think I could ever be cancelled because I will say, yeah, I said it. That's me. Like, I said it. And, or, you know, there's this thing at the moment where people like to call out other people for not talking about social issues or things that are happening if they've got a big platform. And I'm like, maybe they don't have the range to talk about it. Like, they don't have to talk about it if they don't want to. And sometimes I think, I don't think I could ever be an influencer because I would say to people, don't DM me shit because I don't have the range to talk about things that I don't know about. So I'm not going to talk about it. So you can cancel me as much as you want because I'm not talking about it. You can't tell me what to talk about on or what to do like on my own social account. I think there's a lot of desire for people to see people's downfall when they think that they're not the person that they portray on socials. And I think that's another reason for me why I want to remain authentic in every area, because I would never want someone to try and trip me up and say, oh, that's not like you, Karina, or no, that's me. That's me. That 100%, that's me. And I said it. Yep. You know, so I think that's kind of my take on it personally. So yeah, I just hope that, you know, one day I don't bite my tongue and say, actually, maybe I shouldn't have said that, but yeah, that day hasn't come yet.
No, and it's, there's like two things that really hit me is the idea of, in the world of social media, like confirmation bias is massive. This idea of people have an idea in their head of something, and because there's so much information in the world, you can usually find something to confirm anything that you're trying to say, like, say, oh, that person's like this. They're not like who they say they are. You can find anything and twist it and do whatever. So, and then the second thing is, in a more fun way, is the idea of that Dave Chappelle skit, like from years ago, talking about Ja Rule, the idea of when he was talking about things. And it was like, who the fuck cares what Ja Rule thinks at a time like this? This idea of, don't worry, you don't have to have the range and talk about everything. Like,
yeah, you don't. And I certainly don't. If I don't understand something or it's something I'm not really clued up about, I don't talk about it because I don't know enough about it to talk about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I want to talk about you now. Although it wasn't my introduction to you, it's probably the lane, I guess, the Karina version that I see the most, which is you as a podcaster. Although you were podcasting long before this year, but this idea of Black Mums Up Front is kind of, it's reborn in 2021. So I'm wondering if you can speak to the mission, I guess, and the intention of Black Mums Up Front, and just how your experience has been as a podcaster. Obviously, it stems before this year, but yeah, how have you found it as a podcaster?
It's been really fun. Really fun, because it's you can talk about anything. And I think for me, like, so with Black Mums Up Front, you know, we are black mums. We're up front, you know. And I think for us, it's wanting to change that narrative and the, you know, the vision around motherhood. So yes, we are black mothers. So one element of it is to, you know, try and improve outcomes for black mothers and their families. And then the other side of it is to showcase that actually, like I said earlier on, when I said I'm just winging it, just to showcase another side of parenting that maybe isn't always showcased. Like, it's not always glossy, picture perfect moments. Like, sometimes you've got sickle down you from your baby throwing up, or sometimes, you know, you're shouting at your child and then you have to smile at your neighbor because they've just heard you like screaming and shouting at your child. Like, all of those things are normal and they're all experiences that we go through, but nobody ever talks about them. But it's, you know, it's like these unwritten things that happen that no one ever wants to talk about because they want to be the perfect parent. I'm not perfect. I'll hold my hands up and say I'm not perfect. And so I want to normalize the fact that it's okay to not know everything or to not be perfect. And I think you can only normalize that by sharing experiences and for people to know that actually they're not in it alone and they're not going through this whole parenting thing alone. And there are other women out there who experience the same things that they experience, or just to hear a different viewpoint from different mothers, because the four of us are all very, very different. And so we all have very different opinions and outlooks on things. And I think that's what makes it really special, is that we aren't all the same. So we're not always pushing the same narrative or the same opinion. Like, it's very different. But I think for me, yeah, the podcasting experience has been really fun. Like, at first it wasn't, but it's definitely become so fun and so enjoyable. And to see, kind of, you know, we get messages where someone's like, oh my god, I experienced the same thing, and you know, I just broke down in tears because it was so lovely to hear somebody else going through the same thing that I went through, and this is how I cope, so maybe try that and that might help you. But then all of kind of the partnerships and stuff that we have to try and change outcomes for black mothers and, you know, children, I just think it's not what we set out to do. And so it's just absolutely amazing that people want to engage with us and want us to, honestly, sometimes I look at the stuff that we do and it makes me feel emotional sometimes, because some of the messages that we get and some of the things that we're fighting for and that we're advocating for, it's like we didn't ever think that we would be able to affect change. But in some small ways, we are affecting change and being able to give back to the community. And for us, it's really important, because the more that we do that, and over a longer period of time, the more change that we can actually affect, definitely.
I agree. And I think this probably says everything about you as a foursome, I guess. This idea of, I'm a white, single, have no intentions of parenting guy. And I remember there was an episode on a previous podcast that you had, and you were really vulnerable about the pregnancy experience, and it really stuck with me. And it's this idea of, I'm probably could not be the furthest demographic point that you expect as a listener, but I'd learned about you and I wanted to listen. And then, yeah, it like really connected with me. So I think it says everything about you guys as like a team of four. And yeah, I love the dynamics that you guys have, because you're right, you're all so different, but obviously there's this common, like this common theme, this common ground. But yeah, I love it. And the, you know, yeah, you're also vulnerable. And I think when you say vulnerable, I think people think emotional topics, but sometimes it's just being very transparent and being honest. Yeah. And being like, yeah, this might not be like you said, this idea of winging it, it's this idea of, it might be almost a bit taboo, like a bit like people don't talk about this all the time, or, oh my God, I can't believe she said that, or all these different things. But there's an air of vulnerability that is just, I was really drawn to. I loved it. And yeah, once again, I probably am like the furthest thing away from what you would expect from a listener. And I love what you guys do.
No, we love it. Like that, we always say, you don't have to be black and you don't have to be a mum to listen to the pod. Like, you, if you want to just hear a different viewpoint or just have a laugh and a joke, then you know, definitely listen in. And I'm kind of glad Nanadua is not on this pod, because I've been swearing so much every time we do the podcast, and I swear I always have to say sorry, Nanadua. Sorry, sorry, sorry. She's so like, she's so religious. So anytime we swear, if we don't say sorry, she's like, Karina, I'm like, oh, sorry, Nanadua, sorry, 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 I forgot to say sorry. But fucking hell, she's like, Karina, I'm like, sorry, sorry.
I love it. The like personal dynamic alone is like fantastic, like brilliant. And I mean that in like the best way, because yeah, it's this idea of, there's still a mutual respect, but yeah, you guys are just different human beings, and it's amazing. Yeah. I love it so much.
Thank you.
No problem at all. One thing I wanted you to speak on was the idea of, you're on the board for a fantastic organization called BCOMS, which is the Black Collective of Media in Sport. And I was wondering, how have you found that experience with that organization? And can you give an insight into your role as a board member?
I think it's brilliant. Although a lot of the time, again, I feel like I'm winging it at being a board member as well. I think that's, do you know what? Luke, that's how I get through life. I just wing it, basically. Yeah. It's been doing all right for me so far. But yeah, no, Black Collective of Media and Sport is a brilliant organisation. We work with all the major sports broadcasters to change the diversity of the sports media landscape. So it's been fantastic. I've met some extremely talented young people that want to get into the sports industry. And it's always so humbling when they're like, Karina, can we get 5 minutes of your time to, you know, ask some questions? And I'm like, me? You want to get advice from me? Like, I'm winging it. But yeah, it's always an absolute joy to see, you know, the young people that come through our masterclasses and then end up going to do amazing things. One of our graduates from one of our masterclasses from a couple of years ago, he's just secured a job at FIFA as a content producer. Wow. And I'm like, that is absolutely amazing. Like, it's things like that that really make me smile. Like, he's a young black guy. He's going to go absolutely far. And, you know, even just through BCOMS and seeing some of the young people that have come through, I've made some amazing friendships from that. Like, that they see what I'm doing now with the podcast and everything else. And they, some of them are like my biggest supporters. They're like, oh my God, Karina, this is amazing. Like, well done. And I'm like, me, look at the stuff that you guys are doing. Like, you guys impress me. Like, I'm so proud of you. You're doing amazing. Like, honestly. So yeah, it's been a fantastic experience seeing, you know, the young people that have come through BCOMS in different capacities or come to us for like advice or whatever, and then just seeing the things that they've gone on to do, like, it's absolutely amazing. But yeah, as a board member, I don't really know what we do. No, I'm joking. we obviously make sure that, you know, the programs and stuff that we're putting on are fit for purpose. And I always make myself available. If anybody wants to talk to me about anything, I'll always make time and make myself available to have those conversations, or to even put people in touch with people that I might, you know, if I can't give you the appropriate level of advice or support, then, you know, there's other board members that can, or there's other people that I can loop people into. And for me, it's, you know, I didn't have that growing up where, you know, you saw people like black men, black women, Asian men in these sort of positions. So it's nice now to actually know that I'm one of those people in those positions that can actually, you know, affect change and put things in place to ensure that change does happen. Maybe not now, but definitely in the future.
Yeah, yeah. And a big shout out to Leon, because I've spoken to him very briefly and I know he's the founder of BCOMS, so big shout out to him.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question now that is kind of open-ended, and I want you to be as, yeah, just to verbalize whatever you is on your heart and mind. But as I cross my fingers and toes and touch wood and all these things and hope that this pandemic is coming to a close or near the end, I think of what the world will look like post-corona and post-pandemic. And I was wondering if you can speak to maybe some hopes or goals or dreams for Karina, whether it's personal, professional, all these different things, but any kind of hopes, goals or dreams that you're happy verbalizing so we can manifest them in the world?
So family-wise, my hopes and dreams are, my daughter's due to start secondary school in September. Yeah. So my hope and dreams and goals are that she enjoys that experience and she does what she wants to do at the end of it, and that she has, yeah, that she just has a really enjoyable experience and does her best in secondary school. So that's kind of my family goal. I would say professionally, my business partner and I, we launched a business at the beginning of the pandemic last year, and then I got made redundant and then I started a new job. So at the moment I'm currently juggling my 9-to-5 plus my business. And so the hope for me is to still excel in my work. I don't feel that I'm not where I want to be just yet. So the hope is to excel further, but also for the business to take off and, you know, do brilliantly. Not even really for myself, but for my business partner. She's one of the most deserving people that deserves the success. Like, she's so hardworking, so genuinely lovely and kind-hearted that she absolutely deserves for it to go global and to do amazingly well. So that's one of my hopes for professionally. And I guess personally for me as well, I would absolutely love to manifest for Black Mums Up Front to not only go global, but to have a bigger platform to really affect change, but to all really get to have our voices and the voices of the community heard. So whether that's, you know, like a TV show or a talk show or something, just so that, I think there's so many stories and funny stories at that that need to be heard. I think I'm quite funny, but there's definitely, you know, some of the girls that do the pod with me, but then also some that we've had on as guests and that, you know, from our community, they have stories that need to be told and should be told. And so it would be great to, you know, expand that platform and have their stories heard by the world and not just by Black mums.
Yeah. I mean, I do think you're funny, so I'll confirm that. I think you're funny.
Thank you.
No worries. Thank you. And your co-hosts are as well. So I completely agree. Before the final four questions, I want you to shamelessly plug how people can find you, how people can get more Karina in their life, and anything that's going on that you just want out in the universe for people to know about. So Karina, shameless plug, shameless plug.
So thank you everybody for listening. I am Karina White. If you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, which is _Karina, that's CARINAWH. If you fancy visually seeing me, head on over to Instagram, and I am brownstown29. So that's brown as in the colour with an S on the end and then town29. And a fun fact, that's where my mum's family is from in Jamaica, Brownstown. So that's where my handle on Instagram came from. I know we've spoken a lot about Black Mums Up Front podcast. If you fancy listening to the pods, just search Black Mums Up Front on all streaming sites. So Spotify and all the others, you can find us across there. CNR management, we are CR_MGT on Instagram, or we have a website which is www.cr-management.co.uk. and yeah, I just want to we're running a blood drive next month in June on the 19th and 20th in honour of a young man called Evan Nathan Smith, who tragically died 2 years ago. following a sickle cell crisis that he had in hospital. And the reason why we're running that blood drive is because his inquest in March this year found that if he had been given a blood transfusion by the hospital, it's likely that he would have survived. So although the blood drive is specifically targeting the Black community, because only 1% of us donate blood, I would ask that if anybody is listening, even if you aren't Black, please, please, please do register to give blood and to give blood regularly, because there's so many people out there who need blood for various reasons, whether they have long-term health conditions, whether they have sickle cell disease, whether they, you know, have been in an accident and require a blood transfusion, or whether they've had a traumatic birth and they need a blood transfusion. There's not enough blood donors. So if anybody is listening, whether you are Black, White, Asian, whatever your ethnicity might be, please do go out and give blood regularly, because it really, really, really can save somebody's life.
Perfect.
And that's my shameless plug.
I love it. I love it. And yes, everything that Karina has mentioned lives in the show notes of this episode. So please stroll yourself down there. And once again, I'm going to do it whilst I'm here. Black Mums Up Front is amazing. So if you're in a podcast mood, please, please check it out. It's absolutely fantastic. Right, Karina, final four questions. These are questions that I ask all the guests. They're more general kind of thinking about life questions. So question number one, if I gave you a megaphone that spoke to the entire world and you could share one message, what would it be?
Shower every fucking day.
Big, massive fan of that. I am such a fan of that. Put it on a t-shirt.
Because apparently people don't shower every day, and I don't understand.
Yeah, that's lunacy.
So, yeah, that would be my megaphone message. Shower every day, twice a day, in fact.
I was about to say, yeah, I'm a two times a day person, so... Yeah, please stick that on a t-shirt. Number two, what's a personal struggle that you battle with that many people may not know about?
I still suck my thumb.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I've given up trying to even stop now.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's gone past the time. So that's probably, I mean, sometimes I do think, oh, Karina, stop this. But it's a comfort thing. I can't stop. I'm sorry. So, yeah.
So... I'll alter my personal childhood story struggle, but I had two dummies growing up, and I used to have one in my mouth and one in between like my nose and my mouth. I used to like beg her at nursery, because I didn't give up till I was like maybe five. So trust me,
that's brilliant.
Yeah. So that's a problem that even I empathize with, which I imagine you didn't expect. Question number three. What are three personality traits / characteristics that you'd say you've built your life upon up to this point?
Banter.
I love it.
Happiness.
Mm.
Stubbornness.
Oh, they're great.
Yeah, I like to get my own way.
Yeah. I feel you. I love it.
Yeah.
And the last question, this is my favorite question. Many years into the future, your time as Karina White is coming to an end. The person closest to you only has one sentence to describe you and your time here on Earth. What would you hope that would be?
She did it no matter what.
I love it. That's fantastic. Karina, thank you so much for your time. I'm just so happy we made this happen. Yeah, it lived up to even my expectation and superseded it. You're just so fun. So, yeah, I just think people need to hear your voice more. And I'm super, super grateful that you shared your story. Thank you.
Thank you, Luca. Thank you for having me.
No problem. And that is a goodbye to everyone here. So, bye-bye.